You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 233.
On today's show, we talk about Romans in the Swiss Alps, delicious Egyptian mummy balm, and a Peruvian cult leader.
Let's dig a little deeper, but please, God, make the hole big enough to fit all of me in it. Welcome to the show, everyone. How's it going?
Pretty good. How are you doing?
My God. I am with the Civil Air Patrol, as I've probably mentioned before on some shows. And if you look up the Reno National Championship Air Races, that my squadron, the Civil Air Patrol squadron, we have our biggest fundraiser of the year at the Reno Air Races. And we make breakfast burritos in the morning, hamburgers and fries in the afternoon, and it is insane.
Yes.
Now, normally, I wasn't even really going to talk about this, but normally on a really good year, you know, we do Saturday's our biggest day and we do like $7,500 worth of business. You know, we keep a fraction of that, but that's how much we sell. Today was Friday as we're recording this podcast and we did $16,000.
It's like more than double. It's insane. Yeah.
And this is a bunch of people that don't do food service ever in their lives.
Yeah. Like once a year. Yeah.
So
it's crazy. I mean, I work on Fridays, but I knew you guys were crazy. I could just tell by your body posture when you would walk into the RV.
Right.
And I was like, okay, I'll just go see if you guys need a hand. And then I just got sucked into like a whirlwind of activity and work for like 3 hours. And I didn't even know or understand what was happening. It was crazy. It was so busy.
Yeah. I mean, there's not really any archaeology here, but there's a lot of history tied up with the Reno Air Races. This is the 59th or 60th anniversary one. I don't know what it is. It's been a long time that it's been here. The only year they skipped was COVID, really. Yeah. And it's got a lot of history tied up with the city of Reno and just this area in Northern Nevada. I mean, people come from around the world to come to this event. And there's a lot here. And this is the last year that it's going to be held here.
Yeah.
There's a lot of political reasons why that's happening. Nobody's sure where it's going to go, but it's pretty big for our squadron to lose that. But
do you think maybe it could go to, I don't know, Switzerland, maybe?
Well, I don't know. But
that's my attempt at a transition. It was pretty bad, wasn't it?
Listen, I had a segue and I'm still going to do it.
Okay, do it.
Because apart from the roads, the aqueducts, and the sanitation, what did the Romans ever do for us? I'm pretty sure I've said that every time we've had a Roman article.
Yeah, that's not a good transition or segue.
And why are the Romans why are they even going to the Swiss Alps? Seriously, that is not your environment.
That is a good question. And it's probably why this particular site and the article about it is so unique. So
wait a minute. This is terrible, by the way. We probably just lost 100 listeners.
Why?
Because we're just like talking about the air races and then we just shabbily transition to the Roman Swiss Alps.
Isn't that what people love about us, though? That we're like not that good at this and it makes us funny? I don't know. I'm going to go with that.
Right.
So this article is called Ruins of 2,000-Year-Old Roman Walls Unearthed in Swiss Alps.
So apart from their walls, their sanitation, their roads, and the aqueduct, what did they do for the Swiss Alps?
What did they do? Well, in this case, the archaeologist discovered a structure which includes several rooms and a total of about 5,000 square feet. So
go big or
pretty
go home.
Good start. Yeah. Pretty good size structure.
Yeah. That's pretty good size.
Yeah. It's located in a gravel pit in Cham, which is a town in the canton of Zug in central Switzerland.
Canton's probably like a village.
Canton is basically like a state in Switzerland. Okay. Yeah. So it was all very confusing. I had to look it up because I was like, none of these words make any sense to me. Canton, Zug, Cham, like they're all just obviously not English. So that's what it is. It's like a state. And this one in particular is in the foothills of the Alps or this like pre-Alpine area.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And this was the first discovery of a large scale Roman building in the area in nearly 100 years, which kind of surprises me. Like if the Romans were there, they don't do anything small. Typically.
Yeah.
They just like do a whole bunch of stuff. So only finding this
one
like large scale Roman thing in 100 years seems pretty crazy.
Either they haven't looked or they just didn't leave a lot behind. Because it doesn't sound like it's a very hospitable area. So, yeah.
And they also say the preservation is good, but they always say that. But I mean, just looking at the pictures and they're just like rock walls. is that good preservation? I guess it is.
The walls are very good. And then the artifacts themselves are preserved quite well. So that I think is why they say that.
Right.
And they found a variety of artifacts, including glass vessels, Roman tableware, and fragments of amphorae jugs. And
always wine.
I know. The amphorae in particular are evidence of cross-regional trade. And they were used to bring things like fish sauce, wine, olive oil, and other substances from the Mediterranean. So
trade. Romans didn't give up any of their wine. Right. Come on. That was just their normal everyday drinking wine.
Well, you would think that, but I guess just having those kind of jugs there means that there were probably people of somewhat higher status at this complex, meaning that it could have been like a villa of some sort or maybe some kind of compound that belonged to a higher status individual or family or whatever. So you just don't find those unless it's associated with somebody who's got money, basically.
Yeah. And those people with money, they like throwing it around, which is probably why they found several copper, bronze, and silver coins just like laying around. People just tossing their money about.
I mean, I don't think it was just like laying around. They didn't describe the context of the coins, but they did find them.
Listen, the building was abandoned at some point. Otherwise, it wouldn't be here. It wouldn't be a ruin.
Right.
And somebody just like, how do those coins happen?
Do you think somebody was like walking around, like sprinkling coins around for a future archaeologist?
I really don't. I think they were just like, whatever, it's a coin, have it. And it hit the ground. But it does make you wonder when you're sitting on an archaeological site like that, like especially why? Money.
Yeah.
You know, valuables. Mm-hmm. What happened to cause them to abandon it and not like go back for their coins?
It's never on purpose, right?
Well, of course.
Like it fell out of a pocket or out of a bag or whatever.
Bronze, silver and gold coins?
Yeah, well.
It's not like one coin. Yeah.
Well, one of them in particular was kind of interesting because it has Julius Caesar on one side. And on the other side, it shows an elephant standing on a snake or a dragon. And that image is so cool. So definitely check out the pictures in this article. It's a really like solid image of an elephant. It's really cool.
I get a real Game of Thrones vibe from that.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah, I see that. So,
yeah.
And they also found a bunch of iron nails, which nails, of course, would indicate that in addition to the stone walls that they've uncovered, there was also wood structures of some sort there, too. So,
you know, without archaeologists telling us that there could have been something higher than this stone wall, we would never know anything.
Well, the stone walls themselves could have been higher.
Yeah,
but now we know they were made of wood.
Come on. They probably weren't.
Well, the site itself is on an elevated area, and that would have given them a really good view of the surrounding area. So a good area to fortify and be safe and whatever. So I guess that's probably why that they chose that area. And like I said, it could have been a private villa, maybe a temple, some other kind of structure, but they just don't really know yet what kind of structure it was.
Right.
So, yeah. As always, need to do more work.
Yeah, they even had it open to public for a little while, it looks like, according to the article here.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I don't know, did you see in the article anywhere where it was in some sort of area that is open to the public or why they were digging here? I don't remember seeing that.
I don't remember seeing that either. So, No, I'm not sure why. I think the site itself is unique because you don't have a lot of Roman sites in this part of the Alps in Switzerland. So that's part of the reason why the work is happening, because it's unique and interesting.
Well, the Alps doesn't sound like a too easy place to get to from, you know, Rome. So by the time they got there, they were probably pretty smelly. unlike our next article where they smelled delicious.
That was so bad.
Back in a minute. Welcome back to episode 233 of The Archaeology Show. Why do mummies smell delicious? Balm.
Okay, so first of all, the title of this article is like a little bit misleading because I don't think anybody really thinks that a mummy or a decomposing corpse, as they're also known, actually smelled good.
I mean, if you wrap them in good stuff,
it's to mask the smell of decomposition. And you know what? That always comes through. So I just don't know. But the title of this article is Ancient Egyptian Mummy Balm Probably Smelled Delicious. Now, the balm itself probably did smell really good. And
right, but they're covered in it.
So the decomposing corpse, not so good.
Sure.
But the bomb did smell good. And this is from Popular Science. And it's a really, really cool article. I really enjoyed reading about this because I've always been a little fascinated by the mummification process. Because it's like, man, what kind of society gets to the point where that is the process that they do to their dead? It's just so cool, yeah. Right?
Yeah, it's pretty neat.
Yeah.
And only the real high society of Egypt was mummified there,
which was new information to me.
Yeah. Well, yeah. There are actually several few exceptions where somebody who was, you know, a trusted person to the, yeah, to the Egyptian court, you know,
that's where the friends part comes
right,
in.
Right. But even yeah, like lower down people that weren't necessarily friends, but workers, but you know, either way, but
yeah,
typically reserved for the higher up people.
Yeah. And as we'll find out, this particular mummy that they're studying was somebody who was mm-hmm, sort of raised up by her association with the royal, sure, family. So, but anyway, the reason for this is because Egyptian pharaohs wanted to make sure their close companions joined them in the next world.
Sure.
So they extended the courtesy of mummification to their inner circle, basically. And that inner circle could be made up of anybody that they wanted with them in the afterworld, like whoever that, right, that was, I mean, for them.
Honestly, if you believe there's a place you're going to like that and you can bring your friends with you by mummifying them, first off, I'd be pretty terrified because Pharaoh's not going to wait around for me to die, right? So my time is probably limited if Pharaoh goes. But also, you know, are there just servants in the afterworld, in the afterlife? Or do they have, yeah, to mummify servants as well to bring them along?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I don't really know the thought process behind choosing who to mummify. Was it strategic like that to bring some servants to? I don't know.
Right.
But this particular mummy is the body of a noblewoman called Senetne. Mm-hmm. Senetne. And we actually first learned about the mummification process from her mummified remains. She was discovered in 1900 by Howard Carter. And that would be the same Howard Carter of King Tut fame. Yeah. So he did a lot before King Tut. And this is one of the things that he discovered before that. And they did not have a complete body in her case. It sounds like there was some pretty heavy looting that happened in her tomb. But Howard Carter and his crew, they found 4 intact jars in her tomb, mm-hmm, which was in the Valley of the Kings. And they realized that those jars were used to preserve her organs.
Right.
So they did enough research back then and over the years to know that that's what those jars were for.
Which is crazy because with something that's old and they could realize that, you know, this was probably organs being stored inside here, not mm-hmm, really knowing a whole lot about anything.
Mm-hmm.
That's insane.
Yeah, there might have been hieroglyphics or something on it.
Well, I don't think those have been translated by 1900.
Oh, no, not by then, no. So that understanding of what those were might have come later on. The article mm-hmm, didn't specify when we learned that that's what those jars were for.
Yeah.
So, but in the mummification process, the body is dried out and then the organs are placed into jars like these that are filled with kind of antibacterial balms, basically, to cover up the smell of and also slow down the decomposition process.
Which is another cool thing because they didn't really know about bacteria.
No.
They didn't really know about germs.
No, they just knew it worked, right?
Nobody knew about germs until a couple hundred years ago.
Right.
Right? But through trial and error and like some really smelly organs that just like really...
Some like bad situations.
Bad situations, yeah. They determined, well, that didn't work. Let's try this. Well, that didn't work. Let's try this. And they ended up on something that scientifically makes sense, but they probably didn't really understand why.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy to think about, but it's, you know, trial and error, right? You like, you go with what works, and they really landed on something that did the job. So, yeah.
It's crazy. Again, it was so long ago. The lady Senene actually lived in Egypt around 1450 BCE and was the wet nurse for the son of Pharaoh Thutmose III and future Pharaoh Amenhotep II.
Yeah.
So she had some... She had some power there.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Amenhotep, like, that's a famous pharaoh, right?
Yeah, all the Amenhoteps are. There's a few of them.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, she definitely... It's crazy that she was the wet nurse, which would basically mean she breastfed the pharaoh. And then to have, like, a higher status because of that. But maybe they only allowed the pharaohs to be breastfed by somebody of a high status, too. Like, that's entirely possible. I'm not really sure how their, like, social structure worked in that case, but... She definitely was extended the courtesy of mummification. So she was important enough for that.
Assuming she lived her life out. and wasn't killed at like 40 to be joined the Pharaoh.
And like I said, they didn't have her full body. They just had these jars with her organs in them. So who knows when she died, I guess. Right. Yeah. So according to Barbara Huber, who is an archaeologist at the Max Planck Institute in Germany, her mummification reflects an almost pharaoh-like status. Mm-hmm. That's how she phrased it. So, yeah. Guess she was important.
I guess she was.
Yeah. And two of the jars that were found by Carter contained her lungs and liver, and they have basically been sitting untouched in a museum until recently.
Of course. Do you know how much crap is sitting like untouched sitting in a museum?
And we just
revolutionize what we know of history.
It's so interesting, right? Because that's why like you have to preserve some archaeology for the future, because they didn't have the ability to analyze the residue in these jars, which is what they did for this study. They didn't have that ability, you know, even 20 years ago, they probably couldn't do it the way they can now, but they do have that ability now. And fortunately, these jars are preserved in a way that they were able to analyze the residue of whatever bombs or ointments or whatever that were left over in the jars.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
And it's cool what they can tell because, you know, just from a little bit, right? Because as they did that analysis of the residue, you know, they were able to tell a lot about that, including that, you know, probably they were intended to preserve and slow down the decomposition, because I think probably why else would it be in there?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's probably just process of elimination there.
I was like, why would they care about slowing down the decomposition? But I guess it's because there was probably some time in between death and interment into whatever the tomb was. So they didn't want to be smelling bad mummy smells in that time frame.
It's either that, or I could totally see the Egyptians being like, you know, the more we keep this like its original thing.
Oh, yeah.
The more you're intact in the afterlife kind of thing.
Oh, that's true.
I'm just making that up.
But I could see that.
It seems a very Egyptian thing.
It does. Yeah. Well, with the whole afterlife thing, like, that makes sense. So.
Yeah, they collected six samples from the inner walls of the jars and studied the chemical compositions, as we mentioned, and they found remnants of beeswax, plant oils, animal fats, butamine, which is a petroleum-based substance, and resins.
Yeah.
Lots of stuff.
Yeah. And both jars had evidence of the compounds coumarin and benzoic acid.
Yeah.
And coumarin is a sweet and vanilla-scented substance that is found in cinnamon.
Ooh, sounds very fall.
Yeah, right? And then benzoic acid is made from tree bark, and it also has like a light fragranty smell, more of a botanical smell is what I was getting from that description.
I'm assuming this is where the delicious part comes in.
Yeah. I think specifically because the coumarin, which is the sweet and vanilla scented one, that's where delicious comes from. So, yeah.
So are we trying to say that Egyptian mummies smelled like, you know, a nice fall apple pie?
Well, at least until the smell of decomposition couldn't be, you know, covered up anymore. So,
I mean, this residue is still around 2,000 years later.
Yeah, true.
Come on.
I just can't imagine they were that good, but maybe.
Yeah, I guess.
So the researchers hypothesized that the inclusion of these aromatic components were to mask the smell of decomposition, obviously. And also, there were other substances that were not commonly used for embalming, and that's how they're determining that Senene was somebody of high social standing. I guess this rarity of these substances makes her important.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I was wondering about as we were reading this, is the substances that make it smell good, or smell good to us right now.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, who knows if that smelled good to people 2,500 years ago, but either way,
smells
good to us right now. Was that just a byproduct and they just kind of stumbled upon that as, hey, this is good for embalming? Or like you said, were those just added fluff because they wanted her to smell good?
Yeah. I mean, that's a good question. It's almost impossible to know the intentions behind things, right? Yeah. We're just looking at what the final product was, their final result. So,
yeah.
And they do have a interesting source location, some of these things, right? So, for example, one of the resins that was used to store her lungs, it may be damar, which is only found in trees that grow in Southeast Asia. Yeah. So this article was really interesting. And this is something that I kind of dislike about articles like this, is that they want to almost like sensationalize the things that seem more interesting and important. And this would be really cool if this were true. They would indicate that trade was happening on a really large scale to get from Southeast Asia over to Egypt. Like, that is a huge space to cover in the mid second millennium BCE, right?
Mm-hmm.
However, they go on to say that this resin that might be damar from Southeast Asia might also be from the pistachia tree, which is found in the Mediterranean, a.k.a. Yeah. Egypt's stomping grounds.
Have they ever heard of Occam's razor?
Yeah, I'm just like, are you going to go ahead and like assume that it comes from the faraway place or the closer place? Maybe there's more study they can do, more tests to narrow down between those. But yeah. I'm just not inclined to believe the one from Asia when there's one from the Mediterranean, like right there. I don't know about you.
They definitely need more research and evidence to prove that connection.
It would be nice if they could test remnants of other jars from the same time period to get an idea of what those substances were composed of, and maybe they can narrow in further on that. But just this one, I don't know. And the fact that one of them might be from like a region that they traded with consistently, that's really hard for me to believe. But of course, the article like really focused on that bit. So that's one of the problems with reading, you know, just like general, this is from Popular Science, right? So one of the other substances that they found was also for sure comes from larch resin. And this is a medicinal ingredient called Lyrixol. And this is just, it's just cool because it's a plant species that's native to the area north of Egypt and across the Mediterranean. So another thing that they were using to preserve the organs / slow down decomposition / mask the scent of decomposition. So a lot of thought was going into the substances that were in these little jars, which is really cool.
All right. Well, let's go to the other side of the planet and see if ancient Peruvians also were delicious. Back in a minute. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 233. And we're here to find out whether or not 3,000-year-old Peruvians were also delicious. And
nobody's saying these people were delicious. Only you. You're the only one saying that.
Well, we're talking about a cult leader, though. If I'm a cult leader, I'm going to want to be delicious when I die. So.
Oh, wow. Yeah. All right, Hannibal.
Yeah.
So this article is from Business Insider, which is a weird place to find these kind of articles.
What are they doing?
I don't know, but I did actually kind of like the way the article was written, so I decided to go with it.
Mm-hmm.
The title of this article is 3,000-year-old tomb opened in Peru, possible cult leader unearthed. It's a little sensational.
Yeah.
Like that's a little bit much, but this is a really cool burial that was found in a burial chamber during excavations by the Pacopampa Archaeological Project in Peru.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't say exactly where this was, but it's somewhere in the Andes. And I got the impression that maybe they were protecting the exact location, like they didn't want to share that exactly. That seems possible. But anyway, it's in the Andes. So that's the important part.
Yeah, the burial itself is 3,000 years old, as it mentions in the title.
Mm-hmm.
And they know that from relative dating of other artifacts on the site, because there was a number of things found and they're able to date those. Yeah. Relative dating shows up in archaeology so many times.
It does. It's super important for dating this kind of stuff because it's not invasive, right? Like you don't have to ruin anything if you have a really solid relative date, whereas carbon dating or any other of those kind of test-based dates, you have to like actually destroy a piece of the artifact in order to do it. So, and this burial has been named the Prince of Pacopampa, and he is thought to be some type of elite spiritual leader. And you want to know why they think that?
Ritual. I don't know.
They think this because he was found face down with his legs crossed.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, cult leader or vampire?
I know. Honestly, I almost saved this article for talking about in October when we have sort of a like, you know, a vampire themed episode shaping up. Hint,
tell
hint,
everybody.
Hint, hint, coming soon.
Come on.
But and this is kind of like some of the things that you see, but this feels different. It doesn't have the same like vampire connotations that you get with European stuff. And the hypothesis here is that it was a burial position to basically protect against his power in the afterlife. So like once he's dead, he can't control the power that's just like coming out of him.
Right.
So by putting him face down, it protects people from that power just bing, like shooting out of him. That I makes guess. Sense.
If you got power shooting out of you, may as well point it down.
Yeah. I mean, like point. And I guess it comes out forward only and not like right. up. That's, you know what that reminds yeah. me of how like in Star Trek, they can't like deviate away from the plane. Right. Like they're always going like across rather than up or down or sideways yeah. or whatever.
They don't think third dimensionally.
They don't.
Yes. I can't believe you brought up the Star Trek reference.
Well, you make it all the time. It's like yeah. it's hammered into my head because I know how much it annoys you.
I mean, they're literally trying to just like turn around and go away from the enemy when they could just go up or down.
I know. They like do a big U-turn in the middle like, of space.
What is wrong with you? Why don't they? And when they're called to go somewhere else and they're going at like warp speed and you see them do like the power slide and go the other direction. Like, why isn't the direction they're going just like
you straight know, up
at
or
like
down?
An 85 degree angle down. Yeah. Like, why isn't that system?
It's always
down there?
A U-turn.
Oh my God. I mean, I know the Milky Way is on like a plane, but that plane is many light years thick. So anyway.
All right. Well, I only said that because I wanted you to rant about it. So Jesus. Rant done. Moving on.
Yeah. The Peruvians, however, they knew all about three-dimensional travel.
Right. Or power anyway. Yeah. Or not, actually, because sure. it's only down because it only comes out of your body right. forward. Anyway, right. So he was found with artifacts that are believed to have been made from human bone. There were stamps for symbols also found with him. And those symbols belonged to a cult that worshipped predatory animals. So some interesting stuff there.
Well, I mean, they leave a lot out, of course, when yeah. they do these articles, but I also would wonder the opposite of that is like, did the cult that worshipped predatory animals, I mean, kill him and bury him here and,
right.
and put him in that way because of their ritualistic behavior, because they feared him or wanted to shame him or yeah. whatever it meant?
And like, what's the definition of cult in this setting, right?
Yeah.
Because in today's world, a cult is like somebody who convinces people to like...
Yeah.
maybe potentially do things that they shouldn't do. I mean, right. not always, but like it's usually charismatic leader, that kind of situation.
Well,
and is that what they mean by cult, or is it just a group of people who sort of worship something that was a little bit off mainstream, yeah. you know?
Yeah. And they're saying that the crossed legs may indicate that he was a person of religious significance because stone carvings from the time period show religious figures in a cross legged pose, which is different than, like being buried face down with your legs crossed.
Yeah. Like they're just crossed in an X, like one leg placed over the top of the other in this burial.
Well,
but like not, sitting cross-legged is different from that.
Right. But the way they've got it sitting in the picture, and you got to go check out the pictures for this. His lower leg bones, the tibia and no. Yeah. Tibia and
fibula.
Wow, fibula. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm just like totally wiped out today. They're almost parallel with each other. So his legs were pretty unnaturally placed yeah. in a crossed position.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking, man, was the person digging this hole just like over it? And they're like, you know what? I'm pretty sure he'll fit.
Oh, so they just like folded up his yeah. knees to like fit him in the hole.
It was like, that's enough hole already.
Yeah. It is hard yeah. to because when you have a body like this, just the remains, the bones just sort of like fall where they fall.
I mean,
once the decomposition of the skin and everything else happens. Yeah. So
we put significance on literally everything in a burial. But yeah, sometimes,
it's,
you know, people were just as lazy 3,000 years yeah. ago as they are today.
But why face down, though? That is weird, well, right?
Mm. Okay, if I was to play devil's advocate and come yeah. up for another reason for face down, I would say he was dumped in this hole.
Oh, yeah.
Like nobody cared about him, but yeah. they wanted to bury him because they know that animals will be attracted and he'll smell because he wasn't delicious like
yes.
Egyptians.
However, there's other things to indicate that it wasn't just like a dumping burial,
well,
right?
There's artifacts.
Yeah. Because, yeah. and also the grave he was found in is much larger than any other like comparable graves in yeah. the area and in the time period. He's alone and right. they aren't always alone in these kind of graves. And also, his burial is in the eastern half of the pit, and the burial goods are in the western half, and there's actual burial goods. So all of that is like, okay, somebody took care to bury this person exactly the way they did.
Right.
But why? Why? And does it have to be a cult? Does it have to be religious? Does it have to be ritual? I don't know. It's hard to say.
The fact that we put significance on literally every single tiny little detail in a grave... I mean, I understand that people, even today, people will dress their dead relatives in like their finest clothes.
Yeah.
Right.
It's true.
Because of some I don't know. Even if, I mean, especially if it's an open casket, I mean, I kind of understand that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like there's a viewing or something like that. But that being said, is there really significance in literally everything that's found with the person? I mean, there probably is some, but not everything.
It's so hard because when you're applying your modern context to what you're seeing, that is 3,000 years old in this case. Like, that's just, you just don't know what their intentions were. It's almost impossible to say. It's the same with the mummies that we just talked about.
Yeah.
We don't know why they did what they did. We don't have words saying why they did what they did. And we certainly don't hear either. So it's just super hard. And that's why I get really uncomfortable when researchers start saying, well, we see this, so this means this.
Yeah.
Because you just don't know. And this whole cross-legged pose thing, like, just because you see that in stone carvings does not mean that the burial being sort of in that position means the same thing.
Right.
That also feels like a reach to me.
Yeah.
I don't know. I have a lot of skepticism when that kind of stuff happens. But it does seem like this article is sort of an initial reporting situation. So I would imagine that there's a lot more study to be done and peer reviewed publications to come out and those sort of things, because this is just an initial recording.
I mean, you don't think Business Insider really did their archaeological research?
No.
On this?
It's almost like you can tell when the pictures are like these pictures of the cool things.
Yeah.
There's pictures of the burials. There's pictures of the artifacts.
Yeah.
You know, it feels very like, let's focus on the cool things they found.
Well, they got a few cents from us probably by clicking.
Yeah, they probably did.
So that's why they're doing it.
It is.
But
I know I get so like jaded when I think about like the reasons why a news source would publish something like this. And then why the people themselves who are doing this work would talk about it. And they probably just want to get more exposure.
Yeah.
Because more exposure eventually probably means more money for the research that they're doing. So in that case, it's probably, you know, a good cause. But anyway, I'm very interested in it because I've worked in Peru, like I've talked about many, many times, not in this particular area, but I have a little fondness in my heart for all of the prehistoric peoples of that area. And the Facetown burial, that's not normal. So there's something weird going on here. I just think that more study needs to happen to know exactly why. That's all.
Well, I think his friends and relatives were just like, you know what, dude? You're not delicious. So we're just going to dump you in this hole and bury you.
Do you think that like, sorry, not to just keep dwelling on this, but like, do you think that like, it's like a modern burial where like there's workers, right? Who do the actual burying and like all the people and the mourners sort of walk away.
And they're just like get this over with.
Yeah. Do you think like maybe they just were, like you said, like they made the grave a little too short. They're like, I don't like this guy anyway. I'm going to just dump him in and he goes in the way he goes in. It's possible, right?
Tossed in all his grave goods.
Yeah. And put him on the wrong side by accident. But they weren't going to get in there and fix it, obviously.
No.
They had some, I don't know, what's that drink in Peru called? They had that really gross drink in Peru to get back to and drink.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I know
I know what you're talking about, but I can't think of the name of it.
Maybe. Yeah. I can't remember what it's called. Yeah. But anyway. Yeah.
All right. Well, we're going to go make ourselves smell delicious. I just can't get over that. So
I know. I want some cinnamon vanilla scented balm. Yeah.
In reality, though, I think I'm just going to go lay on the bed face down with my legs crossed and just wake up 10 hours from now.
Hopefully. Fingers crossed you wake up 10 hours from now. Yeah.
All right. See you next time.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.